ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It's one of Australia's most baffling unsolved missing persons cases. In 2007, three adults and a five-year-old girl vanished from Western Australia amid rumours of bizarre behaviour, cults and dark secrets.
Yep, because we're trying to track them down.
I'm Dominique Bayens, and I've been investigating for the new season of Expanse, The Nan Up 4.
I was starting to think this is not going to end well.
Subscribe to Expanse wherever you get your podcasts.
Why would anyone move from disbelief to belief? Why trade the visible for the invisible? Hi, I'm James Carlton. Welcome to God Forbid on ABC Radio National. It's the panel show about the things we believe. And experts believe at the census later this year, for the first time ever, Australians ticking no religion will surpass Christians. And it's something happening around the global north. Even in the United States, where 95% believed in something 30 years ago, today nearly one in three Americans say they're atheist or agnostic or no religion in particular. So why in this sea of secularism would some swim against the current? People raised without faith who find themselves drawn to prayer or ritual or surrender to the unseen. To the disbeliever, it can look like madness. Or maybe in a world of clicks and content, the hunger for the sacred makes more sense than we think. Today on God Forbid, why people convert and what they learn along the way, our guests are Muslim Abdullah Kunda, an Orthodox Jew, Kelsey Osgood, and an anthropologist, Tanya Lohrmann. And I won't start with the question, why did you convert? I imagine you get asked a lot. Kelsey, tell me instead, what's it like to be always asked to explain such a personal decision?
That's a good question. I would say that it can be somewhat uncomfortable, and I say this as somebody who wrote a book in which I write a lot about my own conversion, so I'm not sure I have a leg to stand on when I say that it's a little uncomfortable, but I personally still retain a little bit of embarrassment about it because I was raised in a secular, liberal, upper-middle-class milieu in the United States, and religion wasn't a big part of the culture in which I was born. And there was a broad assumption that if you were smart, you couldn't be a believer. These things were incompatible. And I think there's maybe even still a part of me now who feels a little bit sheepish talking about spirituality and about faith. But I think it's a very interesting tension. And so I continue to talk about it. But I've had a lot of questions about why we would opt to live this way.
Abdullah, do you get this a lot for in your conversion to the Muslim faith? Why did you do it?
Ubiquitously.
How does it make you feel?
I'm a very weak person, James. As you know, I've got very strong opinions and struggle with some questions. And so I'll be honest and say I have to constantly remind myself that the person or the group that is asking the question is coming from a really, genuinely inquisitive and interested space. And I just want to respond with, well, this is about the 100,000th time in the past 20 years that I've answered this question, and I refer you to my earlier comments because they haven't changed. But I think also a backstory for me, I became Muslim when I was 18. So I've lived literally the entirety of my adult life as a Muslim and have now lived more years as a Muslim than I did prior to 18. And I have found, I guess, that the frequency of the question is progressively becoming less. I think more and more I'm getting accepted as one of the masses, or perhaps it's also because the answer to the question for me isn't that interesting to most people. For me, monotheism is the radical uptake of responsibility. That for me is the core of what monotheism is about. By embracing the belief that there is one God who is the origin of everything that we perceive, that necessarily means that everyone around me has the same origin, and therefore I have the same responsibility to them. know, I don't see someone drowning in the ocean and say, oh, well, Poseidon will help them, but Jupiter's my favourite god. It is the protest against despair. You know, we forget that the greatest atrocity ever committed against a religious community, you know, the Holocaust, the Shoah, occurred in the middle of the place that had the most post-Enlightenment scholars, the most hyper-rationalist scholars, you know, the most scientists in every field. That's where the greatest atrocity ever committed occurred, in that milieu. And monotheism is a protest against that. You know, it's a protest against both the outcomes of oppression and suffering, that we all have a collective responsibility as well as an individual responsibility according to our own God-given capacity to try and solve these problems, but also to remember that we should be putting in place preventative measures to make sure that things like this, you know, never occur. Never forgetting that, you know, we are not the top of the food chain, so to speak. You know, we're not the peak of what exists. We've got some wonderful gifts as human beings, but we're definitely not the top dog.
But I must ask before moving on, what about pantheism? Why is monotheism the protest against despair, but not multiple gods?
Yes, yeah. Look, I think that as I said, and I'm lampooning it a little bit, but when we talk about polytheism or even pantheism, there is that doorway open to shuffle responsibility to someone or to something else. Whereas with monotheism, we are necessarily accepting that we all have the same origin, therefore the same responsibility, and therefore have to treat each other accordingly.
Well, to San Francisco, Tanya Lerman, welcome to God Forbid. You've spent your career studying people who convert, who make this religious move. Do you find people need to explain finding God in a way they don't have to when they're talking about losing God?
Oh, I think people explain in both cases. But I think that what secular audiences tend not to understand is that, at least from my point of view, I don't think that religion is much about belief. That to the secular person, the presumption is that, you know, they're trying to make sense of how these apparently reasonable friends of theirs seem to have a belief that's apparently unreasonable. And I think it's more helpful to think about faith as a series of experiences that develops and changes over time, and that has a lot of positive dimensions to it. I mean, Orthodox Judaism, I spent some time in that world when I was doing the fieldwork for one of my books. It's an amazing faith.
You spent time among that community as a child, didn't you? A Shabbos goy.
Oh, yes, I did. I was. We lived in an Orthodox community, although my parents brought up as Christians of different varieties. In the Orthodox Jewish faith, what counts is whether you follow the commandments. That doesn't really matter if a little goyish girl next door turns on and off the lights during the Sabbath. So I would do that when I was young.
Just to explain for an Australian audience, the Orthodox Jewish households couldn't on the Sabbath turn lights on or off or the stove on or off, so they'd pay a local Gentile child like you, what, 10 cents to come and do it for them when the sun went down on Friday?
No, there was no payment involved. They would invite me. But what I was so struck by is that faith community really creates a sense of community. You know, there's a period between sundown on Friday and sundown on Saturday where members of the community are expected to be with members of the community, not playing video games or running errands or doing the work they should do in the rest of the week. They're really with other people. And that's a pretty central part of the faith experience.
And you emphasize that word experience, Tanya, experience over belief. So what may seem to the secular viewer, why would you suddenly believe in a God in the clouds who controls the weather? No, it's something much more experiential. Take, for example, the farmer who prays for rain. Is that primarily a story about a belief in God who controls the weather? Or is it a story about a man experiencing the struggle of living through drought?
I would say the latter. But what I was most struck by as an anthropologist spending time in different faiths is that God became a social relationship for people. People came to pay attention to their daily experience in ways that helped them incorporate the sense that there was another intelligence, a mind, an awareness, a loving presence with whom they interacted. And that, I thought, was a more salient part of why people found faith than what you might call a simple belief. People in a drought, they're praying for rain, they would like it to rain. But it's not so much that the presumption is that praying produces the rain. It's more that there is an ongoing kind of commitment to the way the world is, when the world can be a more just and loving place in the presence of a more just and loving God. And people sort of seek to develop that experience. And people, you know, their brains behave as if their relationship with God is a social relationship. You know, their bodies improve. There's a kind of straightforward, you know, sense that this is good for you, which tend to be missed by somebody. I'm not defending a belief commitment. I'm just observing that there are features of faith practice that are quite compelling for people that secular observers tend not to understand.
And Kelsey Osgood, is Tanya putting in words what you feel?
Yeah, a lot of what she says resonates very deeply with me. And there might be some of this that's more obvious, I guess you could say, in the Jewish world than maybe in other faiths. In certain denominations of Christianity, for example, I think there's a lot more emphasis on sort of your internal state and your beliefs, as we're saying. In the Jewish world, not to downplay our connection to God or our commitment to being in conversation with him, but it is, as she correctly describes, a highly communal environment and way of living, and those communal obligations are very important to people, to the point that depending on what your community you might be in, those might be more obvious to the outsider, like walking into the Jewish world, watching people regulate their dietary restrictions, keeping kosher, for example, around keeping Shabbat. Babies are born, people die. There are rituals around all these major parts of life. One of the reasons I think that we're seeing a little bit more attention paid to religious life. Now, whether or not there's a religious revival, as some have suggested or wondered about, I think that remains an open question. But there is definitely more attention in the broader culture around religious life. And I think that's because there's a lot of sadness at people who live outside of mainly faith communities, I think is where you see these communal bonds, who feel that they've lost this. They feel lonely. You know, there's a lot of discussion of loneliness, of people feeling like, I don't know my neighbors. I don't know who to call if I'm sick or if I'm struggling. And I have to say, I feel very insulated from those concerns. I do not feel that I am disconnected from the people around me because I get to live this very, especially on Shabbos, as we've just like, I get to live this very like 1980s life where people are, you know, with a religious one, but where I'm eating meals with people where nobody's on their phone and, you know, nobody's Googling something and people aren't getting in their car to drive somewhere else that they have to be, where everybody's very present with one another. I think, you know, as she's saying, sometimes the outsiders don't recognize those things. Sometimes I think believers get a little skittish wanting to, you know, thinking about the sociological benefits of being in faith communities, but I think they're very apparent. And I don't feel threatened by recognizing those and being a believer at the same time. I feel like I can hold those two truths.
Well, Abdullah, people who convert to a religion often have the reputation, or the stereotype at least, of being quite zealous, quite impassioned in their adoption of the new religion. Remind me of that time you were Labor's candidate for Farah in the 2016 federal election. I remember because both Scott Morrison and your leader, Bill Shorten, criticised you for defending Uthman Madar, your friend, who at the time was spokesman for Hizbut Tahrir. Was that a convert's zeal?
That's a good question, James. Look, I think funnily enough, it referred to a defence that I gave of Uthman from 2013 or 2014. You know, so disappointingly, it wasn't really contemporary to the election, which was all part of the reason that I think the Labor Party quite sensibly dropped my candidacy. I think we were sort of 13 days out from election day. It was an election that we increasingly looked like winning. And when I say we, I mean Labor, because I'm a member of the Labor Party. But yeah, and indeed, you know, we did quite well in that election. So
indeed, you remained on the ballot paper, even though you were disendorsed and got a small swing too.
That's right. Yeah, I think 2% in the two-party preferred. But who's counting? No, I was indeed. But let me be clear and say that Uthman was a very good friend of mine at university. I'm pretty sure it was in 2014 that he'd been pretty poorly treated by the media at that time because he was going to deliver a talk at the Festival for Dangerous Ideas on a provocative and frankly stupidly titled topic. I think it had something to do with how honour killings can be justified or something like that. And he got absolutely harangued by the media to the extent that he ended up moving, because he, to my knowledge, is a dual citizen of Pakistan and of Australia. And he moved his then young family outside of the country. You know, they moved to Pakistan. His academic career was ruined. His PhD candidacy was cancelled. And I was especially disappointed with his Hizbut Tahrir colleagues, of which I've never been one, and wouldn't be able to be one by virtue of my membership of the Labor Party and my membership of other organisations. I was really disappointed with their lack of public support. You know, they seemed only too happy to jump on interviews at, you know, Late Line and, you know, boost their own media status, but weren't doing anything to help this person who was clearly genuinely struggling. So I wrote an article that was very kindly published on the ABC Religion and Ethics blog, talking about why ad hominem is a big problem in social and political discourse. And then, ironically, I then got subject to the same thing a couple of years later, for writing that article.
Ad hominem meaning attacking
the person as opposed to whatever the problem is or, you know, whatever their idea or their thesis is. But, as I said, Uthman was a very good friend in university. We have different ideas.
Do you think religion, conversion to religion, invites us to attack the person rather than his ideas, or invites us to consider the ideas rather than the person?
I think it depends on the nature of the conversion, whether it's sincere or not, and what the root of it is. You know, I mean, if the root of the conversion is to be better than everyone else, well, then it probably does promote utilization of ad hominem. If the objective of the conversion is to be closer to the divine, well, no, I don't. I think it's the opposite. I think it necessitates, that we look at everybody equally, everyone as equal children of God, for lack of a better term.
On Radio National ABC, this is God Forbid. We're looking at conversion. What makes someone change their orientation towards God from disbeliever to believer, from one religion to another? We're with Tanya Lerman, Professor of Anthropology at Stanford University, Kelsey Osgood, she's a journalist, a convert to Orthodox Judaism, and Abdallah Konda, a Muslim convert and a doctor. And Kelsey, so what came first, if I can put it that way? Did you, come to know God and then become a member of a community, or the other way around?
I came to know God first and then became Jewish. I was a nominal Christian when I was little. My parents aren't very religious. Their parents aren't very religious. It wasn't a major break for me to say I don't believe in God. So when I was around 8 or 9, I decided, that if you couldn't see or hear God, God must not be real. And it was sort of this part of this larger plot on the part of adults to keep children in line, sort of like Santa. And so for many years, that was a big part of my identity, that I was a non-believer. But I was a very sad person. And I think I always had a lot of existential concerns. I spent a lot of time ruminating on philosophical questions. And when I was in college, kind of started to reopen myself to the idea of God. Very conveniently for me, right around the time that most of my peers were moving in the other direction. Just one example of my very, you know, bad timing in life. And I started to consider that maybe there was a moral arc to the universe. And that could have looked any number of different ways around that time. And I didn't really start to focus specifically on Judaism for a few years after that, probably 5 or 6 years. So when I was 26, 27.
What goes through your mind, Tanya, when you hear Kelsey's description?
I think that there are common arcs through which many people move across their life. It's not uncommon for intellectually capable, exploratory adolescents to come to the decision that they're atheists. Often that's connected to a logical understanding of how God will work, and the form of the logical analysis will be, well, if God is good and God is omnipotent and God is omniscient, how can God allow pain in the world? I see the pain. And so God must not be there. What I think you see in the way that many human lives unfold is that as people move into the areas of life where decisions are become irrevocable, where they see more people hurt. In a funny way, the logic gets reversed. People sometimes say, as they embrace the idea of God, they believe because it doesn't make sense. I remember when I was in my middle 30s, I had two friends who each had a young child who was in terrible, terrible shape. Both, you know, an unexpected illness. And it happened that one child recovered and the other child did not recover, and that child died. But before we knew what the outcome would be, I was really struck that for one of my friends, there was very much this logical structure, which is, you know, I cannot believe in a God who would allow this to happen. And for the other friend, the structure was more, I cannot make it through this without a God. And I think that that second structure is more powerful and meaningful for people than many secular people imagine. There's a sense in which people imagine people who come to faith reach out for a God who will stand with them in their crisis rather than as the logical explanation for their crisis. Anyway, that's think of when I think about the way that people make choices about whether to move in or out of faith. The greatest number of atheists, I think, is when people are quite young. And then with each decade, more and more people come to a participation in something that is some kind of faith practice.
Which is kind of counterintuitive under the sort of rationalist model. You'd think over the course of time, one would come to be more aware of the literal mechanics of the universe and then come to a naturalist view of non-theist creation. Well, at least that's the stereotype.
Well, I mean, you could argue that with time and age, there's also more appreciation for how little we understand. Again, I don't have a theological horse in the race here. But what I do see is this sense of the way that the idea of God gives people confidence in the possibility of a more good and just world, even if it violates what they see before them.
So, Abdullah, what do you say to what Tanya mentions? Were you, like, attracted to God in spite of it not making sense, or because of it not making sense, to use her language?
Yeah. Look, I found what Tanya was just saying absolutely fascinating. And I'm perhaps at the opposite end of the spectrum in that for me, it pretty consistently always made perfect sense.
And you're not superstitious. You're a doctor.
Well, I like to think that I'm not superstitious. I like to think that I'm a clinician scientist and that I evaluate things based on the evidence that's put in front of me. Now, obviously, a challenging form of evidence in our day-to-day lives is the human experience. And this is obviously a topic of vexation amongst philosophers. How do we experience the colour red? You know, how do we relate what love is? And yes, for sure, we can talk about photons hitting the back of retina and sending nervous signals, and that's telling us something about the colour red. We can talk about serotonin and dopamine cascades, and that tells us something about love. But nonetheless, there is an experiential factor that constitutes what we understand as evidence, right? And I think that for me, it's a combination of both of these things. When I think about what I perceive to be the reality of the divine, we've got some wonderful philosophical arguments that are rooted in some fundamental principles of cosmology in terms of how everything began, what our identities may look like after our physical bodies cease to exist.
What do you mean?
I mean, the best evidence that we have at present for the origin of the universe is that it did begin, that it isn't an eternal universe. And I think we now forget that this is a relatively new acceptance outside of the world of theology. You know, I mean, often religious groups and theologians are derided as saying, well, you're not really bringing any new knowledge to the table. You know, you're not like the scientists. It's not really knowledge. But theologians have been saying since the beginning, literally, you know, since Bereshith, that everything began, that there was a beginning. So that's something that's only relatively recently been confirmed in terms of human history, or in the best evidence that we have presently. In terms of things like the immaterial soul, I don't know what that means. I don't know what it means to have a soul. But even if I took the hyper-materialist understanding of what it is to constitute me, that is the, you know, the combination of atoms and chemical reactions that progressively builds up my identity and my understanding of who I am, there are fundamental physical principles that dictate that information is never destroyed. You know, it can only be changed into different forms. And so, yes, everything that's inside me and inside you and wonderfully inside this room that we're in at the moment has its origin in a star that exploded some billions of years ago. And we know that it's possible, conceivable. In the religious sense, we believe it to be certain that these atoms can be reconstituted in the way that they are now for my identity to re-exist beyond, you know, my physical life. Same for you. So, you know, these for me are principles that at least open the door to, I guess, the rationality, the appropriate rationality of belief in the divine. Now, for me, the capstone then is the experience, you know, that feeling, that experience that there is something there, something supporting, something guiding. You know, we've all been alone in a dark room, in a quiet space where there's essentially no other stimulus. And we know that we're there. You know, that's the classic idiom of Descartes. But I have had the experience to tell me that, but there's also something else there. And I think that something else follows us and supports us through the challenges in our lives. I think it also gives us the challenges in our lives. I think wonderfully, as Tanya said, one can look at a difficult situation. Obviously, I work in pediatrics. So when we're talking about children with cancer, children with terminal illnesses, it's a bit of an understatement to say that that's a difficult situation. But one can look at that and find an experience that suggests that there's nothing divine. There's no meaning to this. This is just cruelty and base life with no meaning. But likewise, another can look at it and say, well, I now have that support behind me. That's something that's always there to help me get through this challenge, you know, these inevitable challenges.
Kelsey, tell me about what you're thinking.
There's a way of looking at life and the world and the way it functions and feeling that there can't possibly be a God. And you can also look at it, I feel like, in that exact same way and feel that there must be a God. I weirdly find belief in God to be sort of like way less complicated than I think a lot of my secular peers might find it. You know, there's always this sort of, how can you believe in the Torah or, you know, or how can you believe in these things literally and also be a person who believes in the Big Bang or, you know, all these scientific truths that I hold, you know, and I find that not that complicated. I feel like it sounds like a cop out, but there's a part of me that just doesn't struggle with feeling that God is real and is there, which is not to say that religious life is like just this, you know, unending simple way of being in the world, because it's really not. But that piece, which I think must seem so unrelatable from the outside, really doesn't challenge me that much.
Is that because you quarantine the two worlds inside of you, or they coexist?
That's a good question. I mean, I feel that they coexist, but perhaps somebody more cynical would feel that they're quarantined.
Well, she's not cynical, but she is learned in the academy, Tanya Luhrmann. What is your response?
So I think that many people of faith hold what I would describe as a faith frame alongside a kind of more ordinary way of understanding the world. So we have a lot of everyday understandings. If, you know, I hear the dog bark, I have a belief that the dog is in the kitchen, I go examine the kitchen, there's the dog isn't there, I say, oh, I must be wrong. A faith frame is a way of thinking about the world with a God or a spirit or a presence that matters. And people of faith often find themselves holding these two different ways of understanding the world in their hands. And often the challenge for the person of faith is trying to allow the faith frame to feel more intimate and visceral and real to them. I've noticed that many of my Christian friends will say something like, you know, God is all powerful, God can do anything. But I noticed that they never ask God to feed the dog. They never ask God to write their term paper. God is somehow used in different ways. And I noticed also that they might say that they absolutely believe, but they often also say that they wish they believe more. They want to be always aware of God, and, you know, yet here they are washing the dishes and they keep forgetting. And when I was really doing my work with most anthropological attention, I remember the day it dawned on me that in a sense, people go to church to remind themselves that God really matters. And there's this challenge because the world is so full of, you know, suffering and misery and difficulty and injustice. It can be hard for people to kind of hang on to the vividness of God as a presence. So I see often the work of faith being a work to make the awareness of the faith frame, the awareness of a world in which God matters, more relevant, more available, more at the top of your awareness. And I see that people change over time and how easy it is for them to make God present for them. And, you know, often the ambition is to experience the world as if that presence is always there. As Abdullah said, you're in a dark room and you know that somebody else is there. That doesn't happen for everybody. And it doesn't happen for everybody at the beginning of their faith journey. But I think you can see the human side of the way that the invisible becomes more salient and more present for people.
And you've talked about this where push comes to shove, when people say they hear the voice of God or feel the spirits of the dead or something like this. This is the thing that really gets the hair of the secularists or the atheists on the back of their neck rising, because that just doesn't make sense. What can you tell me about these phenomena?
So first of all, many more people have many more vivid experiences of what you might call the supernatural or the divine than many people imagine. So we've done a large amount of work talking to people in different faiths and different countries. And the great majority of people have at least one uncanny experience that to them signals the possibility that something like a spirit is present.
In fact, it's much higher than we think because our culture kind of makes you feel like you're nuts, or at least not something you'd want to share publicly.
Yeah.
But that's not evidence of divinity. That's perhaps just evidence of the fallibility of the human mind.
Well, I would say more that the experience is real. That when many people say that they heard God say, or they felt that God spoke, or they felt that they saw the wingtip of an angel, it's often not just a way of talking. It's something they really feel. And, you know, a skeptic can then, you know, wonder, well, what's the real content of that experience? Is there, you know, there's that fancy word ontology. Is it really real? But the observer, the anthropologist, can say, look, when people talk about these experiences, they're describing not so much beliefs, although belief is relevant. They're talking about something they feel as if with their senses. So I spent a lot of time with people who describe themselves as evangelical Christians, and a kind of Christianity in which the congregation expects that everybody in the congregation will have a back and forth relationship with God. And I would see that people would come to the church for the first time, and that didn't happen to them. God didn't talk to them. And they began to pay attention to their inner world in, you know, looking for God's voice in the way that the pastor would invite them to do that. Sometimes they'd practice praying to God in a way that, using props to make themselves feel more confident that they were talking to a person. Like, so I remember one day the pastor said, put out a second cup of coffee for God. You want to talk to God? You're a bit embarrassed about talking to God. You don't know whether God is listening. You don't know whether there is a God to listen. Pour a second cup of coffee. Sit down at the table with two cups of coffee and just talk as if somebody else is there. So I met a bunch of people who would try something like that. I could see that over time, people were more likely to have the experience that this invisible being was interacting with them, and that over time, they would have a more sensory component to some of their experiences. So they were more likely to say, well, I had this thought. It didn't really feel like my thought. Now I know it's God. Or I felt that I was called, and there was almost a hearing quality to that feeling of being called. And that one, I know that is God. So there was a sense of a change in the way in which people interacted with the world in the most basic sensory way. And I actually found that very moving.
Abdullah, do you have similar experiences?
There's really a couple of options here in terms of how we analyze these things. One can take the approach of people like Stephen Jay Gould and say, ultimately, religion and reality, or religion and science, are non-overlapping magisteria. I don't take that approach personally. I don't think that there is that challenge of reconciliation. And I think that one of the wonderful things about the more ritualistic faiths like Islam and Judaism is that we are bringing the divine into the mundane aspects of everyday life. You know, so some people may find this odd when they're listening, but I put my right sock on before my left sock this morning, and I put my right shoe on before my left shoe this morning, and in those acts, I'm thinking about the divine. I'm thinking about God, being there with me. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks used to call this putting the poetry in the prosaic, and so I think that sort of experience, I hear what Tanya's saying, I'm sure it doesn't work for everyone, but for me, that works quite easy in bringing the divine into everyday life. Where do we draw the line? But I think it's almost a clinical question.
The line between?
Well, the line between what is an enriching faith-based life and what is, because we were talking about it before, what is essentially insanity, or what is something that is outside of what we'd consider a reasonable human experience. And I think I can paraphrase the Quran and draw a clinical line in order to do that and say, well, there should be no compulsion in religion. And so to use the examples that I gave of myself, if I felt so compelled to put my right sock on before my left sock that I could not undertake any other action until I'd done that, or if I felt as though I had to turn the tap on and off X amount of times, you know, when making ablution or whatever, having that compulsion, or when we're talking about hearing or feeling the presence of God, having a compulsion in that, that we can't resist it.
But isn't religion all about compulsion? You have to pray so many times a day?
No, I don't think so. I think that there's a difference between understanding what the divine preference is. You know, say in Islam we talk about, you know, the pleasure of God or what pleases him versus the opportunity that I have in making choices to either pursue that pleasure or to pursue, you know, my own pleasure of satisfaction. No, I think that if there is irresistible compulsion, that for me would be, and of course there's always grey areas, but that for me would be the line between which it's an enriching faith-based experience and then something which is not beneficial for an individual or a community.
And Kelsey, so the ritual is important for you. The women you profiled in your book, Godstruck, Seven Women's Unexpected Journeys to Religious Conversion, were they ritual-based too, or other motivations?
I want to just say two quick things, just jumping back to what Tanya was talking about in terms of framing. It might be the case in Islam too. In Judaism, I think because Judaism is a non-systematic theology and it's so famously textual, and there's so many thinkers over centuries who have approached God and Torah and Talmud from all these different angles, there are so many ways in that the onus doesn't feel like it's on me to always be having sort of a mystical relationship with God or with my everyday, often mundane life. So I find it to be very flexible in terms of how, you know, especially as a person who, you know, is kind of leans a little academic and a little cerebral, you know, that's like a completely valid way to live out your Judaism, to be, you know, in fact, it's an exalted way of doing it, to be a scholar of the tradition. And in terms of the ritual life, I wouldn't say, so in my book, I profile seven women who converted to seven different religions, myself included. So we'll just leave me to the side as we've talked enough about me. The other six, I would say that there were some who probably felt more compelled by the ritual components than others. And also some of them ended up joining faith communities that had less of an emphasis. A lot of Christian denominations are not as ritually rigorous. So evangelicals, for example, are not putting on one sock before the other the way that Abdullah and I do. So no, I wouldn't say that they all really felt primarily motivated by ritual. Funnily enough, I think one of my subjects, the first one, became a Quaker and actually to this day sort of wishes that there was a little more ritual. I think for the reasons that Abdullah got into, which I really feel in my own life, that the ritual doesn't feel constricting, even though it is constricting in some ways. It doesn't always feel like I'm open, like every time I do something ritualistic that I'm opening a portal to the divine. I'm a normal person. Some days I'm just sort of going through the motions and other days I'm really feeling very connected. But I think that the opportunity for connection is there. I think one thing growing up in a very watered down Christian milieu, you know, knowing that the few people that I knew who were Christian and sort of my understanding of that faith, it was always a little confusing to me that there seemed to be less of an active component. How do you live out your belief? How do you show that in the world? And how do you behave in that way? How does it impact you? And so I think that for me, living a life in which I have these chances to do that is very gratifying. It's not always easy. I don't want to, you know, sugarcoat it. It's not always easy, but the opportunity is really nice for me.
On Radio National ABC, this is God Forbid. We are looking at conversion. What makes someone change their orientation towards God from disbeliever to believer, from one religion to another? We're with Tanya Lerman, Professor of Anthropology at Stanford University. Her book, How God Becomes Real. Also the author of Godstruck, Kelsey Ozkuch is a journalist, a convert to Orthodox Judaism, and Abdallah Konda, a Muslim convert and a doctor. And much more ahead on God Forbid. Kelsey, tell me about, in the West, this phenomenon that most converts are women for some reason. Why would women turn to religion more than men if one presumes most religions are patriarchal? What's going on there?
That certainly used to be the case, and women used to rate higher on certain aspects of the religious scale. For example, they in some studies, they were shown to be more regularly involved in their faith communities, things like this. There were lots of theories as to why this might be. But interestingly, I think we're seeing that shift a little bit, at least here in the United States. For example, the Pew Center, which is a large research outfit in Washington, D.C., in, I think, March of 25, came out with a study that showed that for the first time in a number of years, the decline of Christianity in the United States had plateaued. So, meaning it wasn't growing. They didn't find that there were droves of converts, you know, outside of churches trying to bang down the doors and get in, but that this previous, what had for the years prior seemed to be a fait accompli, that they were just hemorrhaging people, seemed to have stopped a little bit. And they found that that was driven largely by men. There's also been a lot of media chatter around men becoming Christian, particularly converting to Orthodox churches, Eastern Orthodox churches. And a lot of that is tied up here in the U.S. with the political landscape and, you know, fun things like that. But prior to this, other studies had shown that it was usually women who were more likely to convert or who were more likely to identify as religious. Yeah, so it's an interesting time to be looking at these trends.
Why do you think these trends are happening, Tanya?
So I'm actually not sure about the data of who is converting more or less quickly. Certainly in America, the category of the spiritual but not religious is growing quite rapidly. So it's now over a quarter of the population. In my work, I find that there's a characteristic that seems to be associated with a more vivid sense of invisible others, with gods and spirits and ghosts and whatnot. And it's the capacity to be absorbed in your inner world. And it is true that women score more highly on that scale than men, only by a point, 1 out of 34, 4, but nevertheless, resiliently. And it's certainly been, you know, an anthropologist would say that women are more, they secularize more slowly. I'm not sure why that is the case. Absorption could be one, a psychological predisposition could be one kind of explanation. And interest in a broader inner social world could be another, but it's a resilient observation.
Well, a question to wrap up. What is the future of this phenomenon of conversion? It's been with us for a long time in one way or another. Conversion in its broadest sense, changing religion or finding supernatural meaning in places you didn't find it before. Is it going away or will it remain resilient, you know, for so long as it changes the faithful in profound ways? Kelsey, what do you say?
I'll say this. I converted a little over 10 years ago. I'm from the New York area and I converted in New York, a very diverse place, but not a place people would call a particularly religious one, or at least in the crowds that I was in. And my book came out in 2025. I signed the contract in 2021. And when I pitched the book, it was really more, you know, I had a lot of these questions that you asked, that, well, why, I mean, of myself and of my subjects, why do this thing that looks so regressive in certain ways, you know? We think we have more freedoms, more capabilities than we have at any other point in history. Why limit yourself? And I really put as part of my pitch this idea that conversion had weirdly, even though people think of it as very conformist in a certain way, had weirdly become a little bit countercultural. But then by the time the book came out in 2025, it was a very different landscape. And this Pew Center study had just come out, and there were all these stories about how Gen Z kids were becoming Catholic. And all the questions I got from the media were, why do you think it's now trendy to be religious? So I think that, I mean, I couldn't even foresee, you know, a few years in the future that that was. So I think that I don't think that conversion is going to go away. I think that people will continue to find God in a variety of ways. And I think that religion's place in our world and in our culture will continue to surprise us.
Abdullah, I'm fascinated to know, do you find conversion, going from disbeliever to believer, moving into conformism and conservatism, or is it being countercultural and radical?
I think it's both, yeah. And I think it's a wonderful contradictory dichotomy. Kelsey was just chatting about religion being seen as regressive. Well, British Labour peer Maurice Glassman reminds us that progressive is not a word that we want to hear, especially if we're getting a cancer diagnosis. You know, so progressive is not necessarily good. Abdul Hakim Murad, Timothy Winter, a very prominent Muslim convert and scholar, he reminds us that, you know, society is currently accelerating, you know, progressing in many ways. And he said a lot of us seem to forget the intuition that if we're accelerating, that usually means we're going downhill. As long as people have challenges that mean that they don't feel comfortable in the status quo, that they feel outside of the status quo, they're going to search for solutions. And invariably, some will find that solution in the divine or in adopting a faith or transitioning to a faith that is different from the one that they were brought up in. I don't see it going anywhere. I mean, in fact, I see spirituality and religious observance trending toward the increase. I don't think that's unique to people that sit on the conservative side of the spectrum of society, but I look forward to seeing what happens.
And I just want to get from you, Tanya, to use the analogy, there are, you know, thousands of different ways to point to the moon from different parts of the earth, and you're all pointing to the same destination. Is it the same with finding religion? The ways it will happen, the ways it can happen are infinite, but the ultimate destination's the same?
Well, that's a much bigger and more theological question than you've asked the other two, so I will duck it.
Okay.
I do think that the need for meaning and spiritual presence is fundamental to human experience. I don't see that going away. The channel that it takes may vary, so that in the United States, we're seeing people flow into these non-mainstream kinds of faith experiments. But the basic reach for something bigger and better and beyond you is not going to go away.
Well, last week we did a show on pets, and we had a guest who can see the Holy Spirit in her dog, and I can hear it in yours.
Yes, she does. Exactly what she's doing. She's barking at the moon.
I love it. Well, on that note, I do want to thank our guests for what's been a most interesting hour. Tanya Luhrmann, appreciate your time in San Francisco.
Very, very glad to be with you. Thank you.
Tanya's Professor of Anthropology at Stanford. Her book, How God Becomes Real, Kindling the Presence of Invisible Others. And Kelsey Osgood in New York. Thank you, Kelsey.
Thank you very much.
She's a journalist and author of Godstruck, Seven Women's Unexpected Journeys to Religious Conversion. And Abdullah Kunda. Thank you, Abdullah.
Always a delight, James. Thank you.
Dr. Kunda is a medical doctor and convert to Islam. I'm James Carlton. This has been God Forbid. A big thanks to our producer, Amanda Roberts, sound engineer, Roy Huberman. Until next week, remember to be good. This has been God Forbid.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.